Hello everybody, I'm Gavin Scott, and let me welcome you back to A Journey Through Aussie Pop. We've had a little break between episodes, but we're looking forward to bringing you more interviews with some of the biggest pop artists in Australian music history. And back as well is Robbie Molinari, the host of Joy 94.9's Turn the Beat Around. Hi, Robbie.
Hey, g'day, Gavin. It's good to be back. And a big thank you to all our loyal listeners that continued to download episodes over the short break.
Yeah, it's been great to see more people find our show as well. And that's down to all of you who have reviewed A Journey Through Aussie Pop, rated the show, told a friend, interacted with us on social media. All of that really helps. Now, Robbie, let's get on with it. This episode is one that listeners have been asking us to do pretty much since we started the podcast, isn't it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There literally has been demand and pleas from people wanting to hear the story of Melissa Coutts, the pop star behind the biggest Australian song from 1991, Read My Lips.
Hands off my detonator, indeed. Now, before that infamous lyric and her entry into the pop world, Melissa's first entertainment jobs were as an actress and model. She appeared in commercials and booked a couple of small roles on TV soaps Richmond Hill and Home and Away.
But Melissa's big break would come when she was cast in the role of Nikki Spencer on Channel 10's primetime show, E Street. Let's go to Melissa now and hear her talk about her taking those first steps into the spotlight and the TV industry.
I started in the industry modelling and doing commercials. When I was about 13, 14, I did a documentary, which was like a war, you know, dads and things coming home from the war. And I just played a little girl, somebody's daughter on that. I was too young to even know what was going on. And then I did a great little show called Richmond Hill, where I was this girl who lived on a farm and knew how to ride horses, even though I didn't, and got bucked off a horse actually and almost died. But that's beside the point. And then I went on to East Street.
You got bucked off the horse. Was that part of the actual storyline or was that unplanned?
That was completely unplanned. And they were more concerned about this bloody horse, because it would have cost them a fortune if anything happened to this horse. They were more concerned about the horse than me. I was literally in a ditch. Right. And my first like real on TV acting series, and I'm in a ditch, completely embarrassed, completely covered in mud and shit and God knows what. And they're like, oh, check on the horse, check on the horse. It's like the horse. I was furious.
Was a music career part of your plan when you had joined E Street?
You know what? I don't think I knew what was part of the plan at that moment. I loved acting, I loved modelling, I loved doing my commercials, and I just worked. I got the work. I was very fortunate. I kind of went from job to job. It was wonderful, actually. When I started on E Street, I just could not believe that I was on a show that I had been watching with my family every week. I was invested in, like, I loved it. To then be starring on that show. I mean, it wasn't like what we have now. There's 10,000 shows. And, you know, back then we had a few key shows that everyone would tune in to watch. Now there's so many. So it was a massive deal. Like you'd say E Street, that was a massive deal. Everyone was talking about it. Everyone was talking about the storylines. So you'd go to the hairdresser, you go to the supermarket. This was one of five shows that was on TV, you know, Australian shows. And so to be on that was incredible. Now, I had always sung. I loved singing. I loved performing. Did I think it would happen on E Street to launch my career? No, I did not.
In 1991, once Melissa was established on E Street, the producers of the show came up with an idea for a storyline involving her character Nikki performing a song. Having seen what Neighbours stars Kylie Minogue, Jason Donovan and Craig McLaughlin, as well as Danny Minogue, who'd recently appeared on Home and Away, had all achieved with their respective music careers, I guess they decided they wanted in on that soap star to pop star action.
Now the storyline spun off into a full-blown actual single being recorded, with Melissa going into the studio to work with ex-coup d'etat member Leon Berger and American record producer Doug Henderson. The end result became Melissa's debut single, Read My Lips.
When it was released in May 1991, Read My Lips rocketed up the ARIA chart, ultimately spending 2 weeks at number one in July and going platinum in the process. As songs from soap stars went, it was up there with Danny's Love and Kisses in terms of catchy pop dance tracks for me, and its success opened the door for E Street to be involved, directly and indirectly, with more music. And that gave us hits from Tony Perrin, Teen Queens and Euphoria, but also Bruce Samazan's foray into hip-hop.
Who could forget that? I reckon as far as soap star pop songs go, I'd go even as far as to say it was one of the best. And if nothing else, how can you forget that one liner? If you want to wait till later, hands off my detonator. It's one of the best lines ever in a pop song. For me, it's musical Shakespeare. Anyhow, 1991 ended with Read My Lips becoming the year's sixth biggest hit and also won the ARIA Award for highest selling Australian single. Let's go back to Melissa now to hear all about Read My Lips literally detonating.
They came to me and they said, can you sing, Mel? And I said, yes. And I said, why? And they said, because we're going to do a dream sequence for Nikki Spencer. And in that dream sequence, we're going to have a song, but we thought you may as well sing the song, blah, 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 blah. And that's how it all came about. So next minute, literally weeks later, I'm in the studio recording this song, Read My Lips. I'm on a set doing the film clip, and I'm not even joking. As soon as it came out, before I knew it, it was at number one. I mean, the whole thing was so surreal, and I think it was surreal for everybody else as well. This is how strong this show was. I don't think anyone had any concept, A, how popular my character, Nikki Spencer, was with young kids. You know, the rebellion kind of girl. And I really don't believe for a second that they thought it would do what it did.
What did you think of the idea? Were you happy to jump on board with it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm a 17-year-old girl and they're saying, do you want to go and shoot a video clip and go into the recording studio to record a song? It wasn't a single back then, remember? It was only for the TV show. But even then, I'm like, yeah, hell yeah, let's go. Let's absolutely, you know. And it was E Street. You got to remember, E Street was a bit off the beaten track. It was a bit quirky. It was a bit out there. It was, you know, we had probably the craziest fashion sense that anyone else was doing on TV. And, you know, we had all these dream sequences and it was a bit left field. So it all fit in perfectly well with my character and everything else. So it all made sense to me and it all sounded so exciting.
So even though Read My Lips had probably already been chosen for you, what did you think of the song at the time?
Pop wasn't something that I was into, believe it or not. I was a grunge girl. I loved heavy metal. I loved independent music. I loved my grunge bands. And that's what I grew up listening. So the pop thing, I got it because I knew it was popular. But I wasn't necessarily, you know, a big fan of pop at the time. So when I first heard the song, I said, oh, this is very poppy. But I still enjoyed it. I still enjoyed performing it because I thought it all made sense and it went well. And I was back then, because I was quite naive and I was, you know, in the moment, I wasn't going to say, oh, man, I hate this. I was never going to say that. In a realistic world, it didn't really matter what I thought of it. I was going to do it anyway. Unless it was something obscene or, you know, really, really bad or horrendous. I thought it was produced really well. I thought it was written really well. And I think at the time, it just seemed like something good to do for my career and something that the fans would like and my young fans who were writing into me day on a day-to-day basis would enjoy. And that's what it came down to.
Lyrically, the song created a bit of a stir with lines like hands off my detonator and the clip got people's attention as well. And not just from yourself, you know, you had shirtless male models in there, you know, Simon Baker was in there with the punching bag. Mm. What did you think of all the fuss?
I wish that I was intelligent enough to realise at the time what all of that meant. I had no idea what hands off my detonator meant. No idea. I was not a sexual being at the age of 17. I was very sheltered from my dad when I was younger. I wasn't allowed to go out and party and I wasn't allowed to have boyfriends and I didn't know anything about sex. I had no idea what the hell I was singing or what I was doing other than dancing around singing a pop song. And that is the honest truth. And I did not see the sexual side of it. Even with the boys without their top on, I wasn't looking at those boys going, ooh, wow, get a load of those muscles. I wasn't there maturity-wise. I just wasn't at that peak of my life or where I was sexually aroused by any of this shit. Like, I just thought, wow, I'm on a set and we are filming my film clip. This is awesome. Everyone's dancing around and I've got these cool costumes on. I wasn't connecting the two at that time. And it wasn't until later on, this is a funny story. It wasn't until later on I actually performed, because I performed the song all over the country all year. But I went to a lesbian club and I swear I thought I've never been so scared for my life than when I went to this lesbian club and performed this Read My Lips. That I thought I wasn't going to get out of there alive. They live for this shit. They thought it was the best thing since sliced bread. And I started going, Read My Lips. Oh, okay. Like, it was like that.
You certainly did an amazing job of selling the track and the video clip. I mean, I guess that was probably your acting coming out. What did your parents think of the song and you becoming this pop star all of a sudden?
When I was singing and on set, I was performing. You're right. I was performing. But I was performing to my fans. I was getting into the beat and, you know, I didn't really break down the song and say, hands off my detonator. Oh, there I need to do a real sultry look. Or it wasn't anything like that for me. I was still so young, you know what I mean? And I guess I didn't realize that the people that were around me putting this song on was trying to force that down people's throat. Oh, she's a sex symbol. I wasn't there mentally yet. And to be honest with you, I don't really think my family knew much what was going on either. This all happened so quickly. I'm talking in a matter of a month, I was in the recording studio, then I'm doing a film clip, then I'm doing all this press, then the song comes out on the TV show, then it hits number one on the charts. We didn't know what was going on. And I remember my mum did an interview for 60 Minutes at the time. Ray Martin actually did the interview. And they said, well, what do you think about Hands Off My Detonator? And I remember mum say, well, look, my daughter didn't write it. You know, obviously they see her as a young TV star, pop star, and that's just what they're doing at the moment. Like, I don't even know whether my mum even connected the two of being, oh, you know, this is overly sexual. It just, back then, it's not like how it is now. You know, young people are so in touch with what's going on in the world and their sexuality. And back then, just we weren't that smart. That's a terrible thing to say. You know what I'm trying to say? We just weren't, we didn't know as much as what kids now know. My daughter, who is 13, knows more now than what I ever did at 17. And that is the honest truth. I came from a very sheltered home. I had no idea what was going on in that big bad world. And then the next thing, I'm on East Street and I'm walking down red carpets and I'm getting out of limousines and I'm around people who are offering me drugs and I'm singing songs and I've got a number one single. And I can't, like, even just talking about that, it doesn't seem real. It just was so an unrealistic, amazing sort of experience that we just went with the flow. You know, it's not like I was doing anything overly sexual that a 17, 18-year-old girl shouldn't have been doing. You know, I was well within my realms of what I was putting out there compared to what they're putting out there now, trust me.
How involved was Forrest Redlich in the evolution of Melissa Couts, the actress, to Melissa the pop star?
He was heavily involved, yeah. I mean, it was really his baby. He was the one who came up with the idea. He turned to his daughter, which he told me many, many years later, he turned to his daughter and he said, if we were going to give one of the characters a dream sequence and a song to do potentially to put on the TV show and see what happened, if anything, who would you think that would be the right person to go to? And she said, Melissa Couts. So, and that's how I got chosen to do that. But I think why it works so well is because my character, she was the rebellious one. She had a bit of a chip on her shoulder and the young teens just loved all of that. You know, I was back in those days, oh, I was a massive rebel because I spoke up for myself. You know, these days, again, a completely different story.
Did you ever have the notion that these West Side guys have got my back and my best interests at heart?
That's such a great question to ask. At the time, everybody around me, I loved, I trusted, I adored. I didn't know any other better. I mean, I was a girl that went to school and came home. You know, I didn't know what was out in the big bad world. I didn't know people were out trying to make money from me and trying to do this. I saw people at face value. I always thought they had my best interest at heart, my family's best interest at heart. I thought, well, I'm a really nice person, so why wouldn't they treat me really nicely? That was my mentality. And I know I'm not putting myself down. I was ignorant to the industry and how callous and rough it can be. So it's not coming from a place of stupidity. It's coming from a place of just having a good heart and seeing the good in people. And I'd always been brought up, you know, treat people like you wanted to be treated. And I just thought, well, obviously everyone else has been brought up that same way. And everyone, you know, I'm a really nice person, so they're going to be really nice back. And that's what my mentality was. To be honest with you, Forrest, I never had an issue with Forrest ever. I can only speak on how Forrest was with me. And he was always very polite, always very cordial. There was, I can't say one thing that he did where I thought, oh man, that was so dodgy. So I've really got nothing bad to say about Forrest.
Off the back of the success of Read My Lips, West Side Records was born and spawned quite a few top 40 hits from the likes of Radio Freedom and the Teen Queens. What was it like being a part of that pop roster?
Look, it was exciting. It was really exciting. And believe it or not, you know, even at the age of 17, I mean, I worked really, really hard on acting and singing and tap and jazz and auditions. And, you know, I was every day out of school, I was doing singing lessons or this lessons or theatre history lessons or this. I did not stop. So for me, it was like, okay, well, this is it. This is what it feels like. You know, I'm doing what I said I was going to be doing. And I didn't go off to university. So I was just so grateful that I was able to work in the industry that I had loved so much and amongst big hits at the time. You know, it was all about pop music. It was all about what we were doing.
Did you ever cop any backlash from the whole, oh, here's another soap star releasing a single?
When it was happening, I never got, from what I recollect, I never got any backlash. I was riding that high wave and I was having the time of my life. Now, of course, when that dies down, that's when everyone likes to jump on the bandwagon and say, oh, well, you know, how good was it? And blah, 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 blah. But at the time, everyone fucking lived for it. They loved it. They loved writing about it. I was everywhere. And then as soon as it starts to slow down a bit, oh, when's the next single coming? When's the next single? Then everyone jumps on, oh, you know, she's just a soapy singer. And I don't know, I didn't read into anything bad or what they said, but I'm sure that bad things were said. And that's just part and parcel of the industry, unfortunately. And when you are high, they love you. And when you are down, they jump on the bandwagon of you being down. It's just how human society is. It's just how it is. I mean, not that I'm comparing myself in any way, shape or form, but look at Kim Kardashian, where back in the day she was just running around with Paris Hilton. No one gave a shit who she was, blah, blah, blah. Then even when she was doing the Kardashian, oh, she's just a girl on the Kardashian. Now that she's a fucking billionaire, right? Now all of a sudden we're wearing all the big designer names and, you know, look what she's done for herself and everyone's fucking paying attention now. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's such a funny industry, this industry, and you've got to have the thickest of thickest of thickest skin. And some people get through it unscathed, but there are a lot that have a lot of issues and do not. It's just a hard industry. And you've got to take the good comments with the bad. And you've got to know that you are never going to please everybody.
Given how well Read My Lips had performed, it was inevitable that Melissa would release a follow-up. Sexy is the word in brackets, was put together with Leon Berger co-writing with Tony King and Roy Nicholson, the same writers of Read My Lips, and producing with Doug Henderson and Alston Kosh. And for me, it was an even better tune than Melissa's debut. Let's take a listen.
And That song was everything you could want in a follow-up. I mean, Read My Lips had been huge, and this track was just as strong and equally as ambiguous with its lyrical content. At the time, I thought Sexy Is The Word was a great track, and 32 years later, I stand by my word. And I wasn't the only one who thought so. When the track was released in September of 1991, it debuted at number 15, and within 4 weeks, it had reached its chart peak of number 3 and stayed there for 2 weeks, and achieved gold status in the process, selling over 35,000 copies. Let's go back to Melissa now to hear all about Sexy Is The Word.
I didn't have much say in the next song either, unfortunately. So there would have been massive pressure for the team behind it. And obviously I had to like it too. I mean, you know, I am putting myself out there as well, and I am the one who has to get on stage. And so obviously, I did want it to be something exceptional. I would have liked if I was part of that process of, you know, maybe writing some of it, or just to see me as an artist rather than just to see me as a person they're fronting in front of a film clip. It would have been nice for them to say, Mel, we're writing your next song. Would you like to be a part of that? Back in the day, a lot of that was happening where you were just handed the song, go out and sing it kind of thing. So in hindsight, looking back, I would have liked to be part of that process. But I did think Sexy Is The Word was a good track. I did. Did I think it was going to do as well as Read My Lips? I wasn't sure. Did I think it was going to go to number 2 or whatever it did? I couldn't believe that it did so well again. You know, it was amazing.
Up until this point, Melissa had been juggling her music career and her continuing role on E Street. But that all became a bit too difficult as her pop success skyrocketed.
What was the hardest thing about juggling E Street and the music career taking off?
No sleep. Because I would get to set at 5 in the morning, I'd go into makeup. I would have had to have learnt maybe 14 scenes for that day. Then I was going to, straight from East Street, I was going to the airport. I was getting on a 2-seater plane and I was travelling to either Adelaide or Perth or Queensland or Melbourne to do a gig. Then I would get back on the 2-seater plane and maybe go back to the hotel for a couple of hours and fly back home at like 4 or 5 in the morning. And then go straight to set again. So it at the peak of it, I mean, it was out of control. It was out of control. I was living out of a suitcase.
Did you ever notice any friction on set at E Street when that was happening for you?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
I did. I mean, look, I think it is hard because it was so huge. You've got to imagine. It's something like that sort of wouldn't happen now because we don't really have those big, big, you know, one star that everyone's sort of looking at or a couple of stars. It's so hard to express to you unless you were there, like you would have been. But for younger people growing up now, what it was like, it was just, I'm just trying to compare it to somebody. It's just, it was huge. And I think a lot of people didn't realize, especially the people that I was working, they didn't realize how big it was going to be either. I mean, it did great things for the show, I guess, but I don't know whether there was any jealousy or anything involved. I pretty much kept to myself. I didn't have time to do anything else. I had to go there and work, and my work ethic has always been exceptional. So I would turn up there at 5, even if I've had 2 hours sleep, an hour sleep or no sleep, and I would still know all my lines and I would still perform to the best of my ability. I never turned up on set drunk or had been out the night before and, you know, was getting over a bender or didn't know my lines, or I was always, always professional.
So with her musical commitments outweighing those of her acting, Melissa decided to leave E Street and focus wholeheartedly on being a pop star. She devoted her attention to making her debut album and this track, her next single release, Skin to Skin.
I thought Skin to Skin was another solid pop song, once again from the same team. It charted slightly lower than Melissa's first two singles, peaking at number 16, but given she was no longer on TV screens each week as a cast member of E Street, that was kind of understandable. And a top 20 single was nothing to be worried about. Let's hear from Melissa now about what it was like being able to devote all her energy to her music career.
It felt good. I did miss E Street though, because I love acting so much. And that was hard for me to leave E Street because I felt like I was sort of leaving my security blanket. I wasn't a massive fan of Skin to Skin, to be honest with you. They've got in a stylist and I just didn't really gel well with her. And I just didn't have that same warm feeling where I sort of wrap my arms around Read My Lips and Sexy is the Word. Skin to Skin just, I don't know. I just didn't love it as much, I'm going to be honest. I don't think I've ever said that in an interview in my entire life. I just didn't love it as much as the first two. So I was a bit scared. And then to not have the show and just to be concentrating purely on music was hard. And also, I just wanted to be more part of the process, I guess, at that point. But I did feel as though that a lot of people had jumped on the bandwagon to try and keep it going.
Was that a decision that was made for you, or were you
what
leaving East Street at that time?
You know, I'm trying to remember. It got to a point where there was just no time for East Street. I mean, I was literally gigging or doing some kind of performance or appearance every single day, doing photo shoots, interviews. There was no time to do a 13-hour, five-day-a-week show. It was just so crazy. So I think it was a decision, I don't know whether Forrest made it or not, but they just wanted to push that music side of things because it'd been going so well. And they thought maybe that being on E Street was sort of slowing it down.
In June of 1992, Melissa released her long-awaited debut album, Fresh. Arriving 13 months after Read My Lips, the album debuted at number 21 and peaked at number 15 on the ARIA Albums chart. Could the album have fared any better if it were released when Read My Lips was at its peak? Well, of course. But no one, not even the producers of E Street, could foresee the success and the demand that Melissa would command. Although Fresh was late on the release schedule, what we did get was a very polished and strong pop record made up of 10 outstanding tracks.
We'll be talking about the album in more detail in the bonus material for this episode. More on that at the end of the episode. But for now, let's take a listen to the fourth single from Fresh, My House, which was released in November 1992, by which time Melissa had returned to E Street, and I'm guessing that's why they put another single out. Shockingly, My House missed the top 100 entirely. Now, I didn't think it was as strong as the three previous singles, but for it not to chart at all was quite surprising.
It was actually still an okay song, but to go from, you know, having three top 20 consecutive singles to the fourth single not even charting in the top 100, I mean, where did her fans go at this point?
Yes, it was a bit of a surprise. Now, let's hear from Melissa about how the album and its final single unfolded.
So next on the schedule was the album, Fresh, and it was produced by Leon Berger, and it was also co-produced by Doug Henderson. What are your memories of working with those guys in the studio?
I loved it. They were perfectionists, though. They knew exactly how they wanted each word, each line to sound. But being in the recording studio, it was amazing. I don't know what to say. It was incredible. I loved it. You kidding me? I'm like 17, 18. I'm going to work and I'm in a recording booth. It was incredible. It was an amazing experience.
They were very directive, you know, sing it like this, or can you redo this? Can you redo that?
Yeah, they were. They were. I'm not going to lie. They were. But it was still a fun experience. I never felt like, oh my God, get me out of this hellhole. It wasn't like that at all. It was a good experience. And they were respectful of me and my age. And they were always, they always took care of me when I was in that studio. I never felt like, ugh, I'm here with these two creepy men. It never, ever felt like that at all. They knew I was a young person and I was there without a parent. And so there was nothing untoward going on there. They just had so much control over that first lot of music. And I just thought, you know, without me, that wasn't going to work. So why not just include us all? I think they forgot that I was this young girl who wanted to continue a career in music. And I just wish I would have been a little bit more considered.
Usually artists, when they don't write their own songs, but they've recorded music, after 30 years, they actually own the rights to that, to do what they want with it. And still to this day, I'm not able to do that with Read My Lips or with Sexy's Word or that whole album, actually. over the years, I've had people wanting to use the rights for Read My Lips on for this and for that, even on the Oprah show. And they just said, no, 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 no. So I just kept hitting a sort of a wall. And I'm just thinking, why would you do that? Why? Yeah. And then I had some, I had some dodgy managers. My God, you're touching on a nerve now that is in the cellar in my brain that I don't like to go to very often. But there was some traumatic times.
Yeah, I mean, I did want to ask whether there were any horror stories, but it sounds like you probably did encounter some, unfortunately, along the way.
Many. And I'm not talking about Forrest Redlich, because as I said, I've got nothing but fond memories of Forrest. That's the honest truth. I'm talking about people who sort of started to look after me after that and managers and things like that. I had some great managers, but man, did I have some devils for managers. Whew, man. They just saw me as a money machine and they forgot that there was a human being actually, you know, there, not somebody that was just making their money.
Did that tarnish that experience of creating that first album?
Fresh was okay. I think it was more after Fresh. Like when I was recording Fresh, that was all really great. It was a really good experience. But again, I just, I felt like I was being managed, you know, rather than it being like now these days, you know, you see all these young artists are coming out and they're contributing to things. And I don't know. I just think I was just a bit too young still and naive to really know what was going on. That part was all a really good experience. It was afterwards when just everyone's greed just got worse and worse and worse, you know. But, you know, the whole Fresh album, the Fresh experience, that was still really, really positive and it was amazing and I was enjoying it. And at the time I had a really great manager and, you know, it was more after Fresh really, I think, that, you know, I sort of ran into the wrong kind of, you know, the wrong people sort of got involved.
There was one fourth and final single that came off the LP, My House, which didn't chart as well as the others.
Oh.
Did that bother you at the time?
Oh, I'm sure it did. I can't remember. I'm sure it did. I mean, I didn't think it was as strong or as fresh, funny enough, as those first two singles. My House, I mean, listen to My House. It's just not as good. You know, it's good, but it's not.
I would have gone with Let's Get Pumping.
Yeah, I like Let's Get Pumping. That's funny, isn't it? But I thought the My House video clip was very good. I thought the hook was okay. I just thought it lacked something.
1993 was a time of change for Melissa. East Street was axed and she started work on a new drama series, Paradise Beach. And musically, she released a brand new song called Is It? ...
Released in June of 1993, Is It? Debuted at number 39 on the ARIA singles chart, but never managed to climb any higher. Again, it was a little disappointing that the song didn't do better, because I don't think there was anything wrong with it as such. You know, there was a definite growth in sound and lyrical content. I guess it just didn't connect with as many people. I particularly love the rap in the track performed by a young Tony Copper, who would later go on to front Aussie funk band The Truth. Let's go back to Melissa now and hear all about Is It?
Can we talk about the styling for Is It? Because it was a bit of an image overhaul.
Oh, my God, and I hated it. I fucking hated it. That was the one that I really hated more than even My House. I loved the look of it and everything. I know they were going for that guest girl and that whole thing, and that was a lot of fun. Like, I thought the film clip was incredible, even though I wasn't a massive fan of the song. But that Is It, oh, my God. Oh, my God, that stupid cape I had to wear and those stupid shoes. And I actually had a woman who came on board who was the stylist to recreate the look for me. And I think she was just buying all the stuff that she was into and that she really loved. And even though I was saying, I'm just not feeling this at all. This is just not a bit of me at all. It wasn't grungy. I don't even know what it was. It was just weird. But I went with it. I went with it because I understood that we needed a new image and all the rest of it. And I thought, well, okay, if this is obviously she knows what she's doing. She's the stylist, yada, yada, yada. But, I wasn't a fan. But I thought the film clip was quite good. I thought the, you know, the shots over the Harbour Bridge and the car and stuff, I thought that was pretty cool. But yeah, anyway.
Okay, this is the point where things get a little murky. Melissa's releases to date had featured a variety of labels and companies listed on the back covers. There was Phonogram and Mercury, labels under the Polygram stable. There was Laser Records, which was linked to Westside Productions, the production house behind E Street. There was Powerhouse Records, which was linked to Powerhouse Studios, where Melissa had recorded Fresh. And Powerhouse also put out a couple of other projects Leon Berger was involved with. It feels like there were lots of different fingers in the pie, so working out why there weren't any more releases after Is It is a bit tricky. But it's likely the decision not to move forward came down to Polygram, because as we know from our Radio Freedom episode, Westside Records wound up around this time, and of course Melissa wasn't tied to E Street anymore. Also, Is It had nothing to do with Leon Berger or Powerhouse, so I'd say it was a Polygram decision.
Yeah, sounds likely. So with music on hold for the time being, Melissa focused on her acting, working solidly over the next decade and appearing on shows like Pacific Drive, Echo Point, Medivac, and All Saints. Let's go back to Melissa now to talk about this time in her career. Was there a plan to do a second album at any point?
There was. There was a plan to do a second album. I'm not quite sure what happened, to be honest. I can't remember. I really don't know what happened. Again, I think it was partly greed. I think people were fighting over contracts and fighting over this, that, and the other. And I just think it got so big and no one knew what to do with it. And then bad management sort of didn't drive the narrative, if you know what I mean. You look at Kylie Minogue's manager, and he really got in there and managed her career in those early years and really drove it. You know, got some really good songwriters on, and, you know, Kylie went over to the UK and he really managed her career early on to perfection. Where with me, unfortunately, I just copped all the wrong people and they just let it fall on the floor, which is so sad, because if they would have protected the Melissa vibe and image and what we were trying to do, I think then we would have had another successful album and another and another.
So things just, did they just fizzle out on their own, or was there ever a discussion of things ending with the label after Is It?
No, there wasn't. All I remember at the time was it was just poor management decisions, really, because I was there. I was ready to work. It wasn't like I was a drug addict or an alcoholic, or I was there ready to work. Let's go. What are we doing? What's happening? And it just sort of, no one wanted to take it the reins and say, right, this is what we're doing. Or maybe they did and it didn't work. I really can't remember. I really don't know why that second album never sort of came to fruition.
Throughout the 90s, you continued to work constantly and you were just, you know, booking jobs off the back of that.
Oh, yeah. And I did every TV show that ever was. And then I did everything. I did Pacific Drive. I did Echo Point. I did Medivac. I did All Saints. I did Home and Away. I did, you name it, I bloody did it. I was working. But for some reason, I don't know what happened with the music, why they allowed that to fizzle out when it had been so successful.
More than a decade would pass until, by some sheer force of pop black magic, Melissa Kautz made a musical comeback in 2005 that I don't think anybody saw coming. It was all very well executed, and it started off with a cover version of a big song from the 80s, originally made famous by Sheila E. Let's take a listen to the original version and then Melissa's remake of The Glamorous Life. Melissa's cover of The Glamorous Life brought her back into the top 40, peaking at number 31, and she followed that up later in 2005 with a full album, Lost and Found, and second single, All I Want. Melissa's going to tell us now about that amazing musical comeback. What prompted that return to music in 2005?
I wanted to record again. I wanted to do it again. but I wanted to do it right with the right people and be looked after. Let's just do this. Let's do it and let's everyone have fun and everyone enjoy the experience.
Were you able then, of course, to draw on those experience from doing Fresh and you know, right those wrongs a little bit?
Oh, yes, yes. And I mean, when I did Lost and Found, I had an amazing manager. I had amazing people who were backing me. It was a wonderful experience. It was a lot harder because you don't have East Street was such a huge show. So you don't have that platform to sort of get it out there and things like that. But Lost and Found still did quite well. And it was such an enjoyable experience. But again, it would have been nice to have a follow-up album and another follow-up album. But it's just been so, there's been always such that sort of disconnect, which, yeah, has been hard.
Where did the idea of covering The Glamorous Life come from?
My manager at the time, Penny Clifford, she was a massive fan of the song. I had never actually heard it before, but it's such a good track. It's still one of my favourite songs to perform. I just love it so much. I really thought it was the first time I eventually, as I got older, really loved dance music. Still not so much pop, but I really loved like the you know, the sort of underground dance music that's coming on and just that Glamorous Life, that beat, it was so good. I just loved it so much.
I mean, you looked completely in control and confident in the video clip.
Yes.
Did you feel that way?
Yes. It was a completely different partnership because I knew what I was doing. I knew more about who I was as a person. I was a lot stronger mentally and I got to have a say. I was involved and when I was portraying sexy, I knew what sexy meant. You know what I mean? It was just different all around.
What were your goals when you set out to make that record?
I just wanted to continue to make music. I wanted to continue to record. I wanted to continue to make music. I actually was planning to go overseas and then my dad got really sick with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and he was dying. And I just before 2008, I think it was, I had an agent set up in the States and I was ready to go over there and I don't know, just see what could happen over there, I guess. And my dad got really, really sick. And yeah, because we always had such a close family, there's, you know, my sister, my brother, myself, and my mum and my dad, and we'd never lost anyone. And it was just horrific, you know. It was just like we watched our father wither away to nothing in 6 months. And after that, I just couldn't go. I just couldn't go. I completely shut down for years and years. It took me a long time to get over the death of my father, a long time.
Sorry to hear that, Mel. You actually wrote and dedicated a track to him on that record, Goodbye Daddy.
Yeah, it was a hard song to write, but it just, yeah, I guess it's where I was at the time. But I don't know, it was a weird time, you know, after my dad died. It was a very weird time mentally. I think, you know, I struggled mentally as well, hugely. I was seeing a therapist and, yeah, I needed a bit of mending come that time. So I don't know whether I would have been ready to work straight away anyway, to be honest.
New music kept coming over the next 10 years with Melissa releasing a number of standalone singles, including Easily Affected, a track produced by Swedish duo Nicholas Bergwall and Nicholas Kings, professionally known as 2N. Get it? She worked with local talent, DJ and record producer Nick J on a track called Something About You in 2011, as well as Nick Skits on cover versions of Transvision Vamp's I Want Your Love in 2008 and Cheryl Lee Ralph's In the Evening in 2015. Let's take a listen to a few of those releases, including my personal fave, Easily Affected, Something About You and In the Evening. Then we'll go back to Melissa to hear about making music in the noughties.
Just
love working with, you know, all different types of producers, and it's so much fun now because, you know, I am more involved and you just know who you are more as a person. And, you know, I've got such amazing fans that have stuck with me, like back in the E Street days, Read My Lips fans who are just there. They're waiting for, oh, Mel, when's your next track coming out? And I mean, loyal fans. And that's what drives you. That's what, you know, that's what makes you want to do it again. And my love for performing, you know, getting up on that stage in front of people and singing my songs, even to this day, like I get so much enjoyment out of it. It's just so cool. And I'm working with these new producers now overseas. And yeah, I just want to get music out again. It's fun. I just like it. And if people want to hear it and there is a market for it and they, you know, they're enjoying it, they're dancing to it, it's fantastic.
So there are plans to potentially release some new music?
Definitely. That is the plan. I'd like to get out a few singles and then maybe put together like a collaboration of everything, which would be so cool. And just to be able to perform them, it's so much fun. Like, it's so much fun going into a club and doing a couple of songs and, you know, it's awesome.
Now, although I've spoken to Melissa before, as have you, Robbie, this was the first time I've heard her say some of the things that she said about her music career. And it strikes me as yet another case of a pop artist getting railroaded by an industry that had no support systems in place for young talent, something we've heard about way too often on this podcast. But despite all that, Melissa has good memories of her time as a pop star. Let's hear them now.
Oh, look, I loved it. I was doing everything that I loved doing. After recording Read My Lips, Sexy Is The Word, I actually really, really then got into pop music and just to be a part of that era and just what was happening. Pop was huge. And just to be this pop star, if you like, you know, and go around the countryside and sort of gig and it was just so cool. Like I remember I did a tour and I had like an 8-piece band for that first album. And nothing beats that experience. It was magical. It was so cool. It was just so much fun. So much fun.
I have so much admiration for Melissa, and if it's possible, more than I did before we sat down to speak with her and hear her journey. I like that in one way or another, Melissa has always been around, whether that be in Real Housewives of Sydney, gracing men's magazine covers like Ralph, or making personal appearances at a gay or lesbian bar belting out her pop hits.
Yes, what a great and varied career Melissa has had. But for so many of our listeners, it's the fresh album that holds the fondest place in their heart. And as I mentioned, we're going to go through that album in the bonus material. That's right, Robbie and I are going to do another track by track, talking about all the songs that we didn't get to talk about in this episode.
So we're going to sit down and have a good listen through it one more time and see how it stood the test of time.
That's right. So to listen to that, head to chartbeats.com.au/Aussie, where you can subscribe to listen to all the bonus material. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another episode. We're not going to leave you hanging for a couple of months this time. We're going to get straight back into it. Until then, check out Robbie on Turn the Beat Around every Friday at 8 p.m. on Joy 94.9.
And of course, we're all over the socials, aren't we? So I'm at Joy Turn Beat Around. And of course,
I'm at ChartBeatsAU on Twitter and Instagram, or find ChartBeats A Journey Through Pop on Facebook. Okay, thanks for listening. See you in a couple of weeks. Bye.
See everybody.